Hello, and welcome to another edition of Drug Fix, the Pink Sheet's Pharma Regulatory Podcast. I'm Derek Ingery, an executive editor at the Pink Sheet, and I'm joined by senior writer Sarah Carlin Smith, senior editor Sue Sutter, and editor-in-chief Nielsen Hobbs. Today is April 12th, 2024. We had a major oncology conference this week that brought a lot of interesting news on the regulatory front. First up is advisory committee reform. Richard Pazdur, director of the Oncology Center of Excellence, who is not shy about voicing his concerns, criticized the evolution of the open public hearing in ADCOMS. Sue, what is his problem now?
So yes, Dr. Pazdur is not shy about expressing his concerns and his beliefs. He is upset and about how the open public hearing has sort of evolved over the years, at least in the oncology setting, and is really driven by people who support the sponsor and have financial and or other support from the sponsor, including patients who have nothing but good things to say about the sponsor and their drug, as well as professional clinicians and key opinion leaders who use those drugs and want to see their use either approved or expanded. And he believes this, the open public hearing should go back to more of what he called an organic process, where members of the public shared their feelings on an issue, but those feelings were sort of more diverse. And he noted that in 25 years of being at the FDA, he's never had somebody come to the committee and say that they were harmed by the drug or they did not get any benefit from the drug. He's also concerned about sort of the influx of investigators who speak during open public hearings now, and it, particularly you do notice it a lot in the cancer setting as well as in the rare disease settings, and that many of these individuals have personal or academic relationships with committee members. And he thinks this has the potential to drive a lack of confidence in the system.
So yeah, I don't think that this is necessarily an oncology problem. I mean, we've all sat through all different types of advisory committee meetings, and the first, you know, either if not all of the open public hearing speakers, but most of them start their little 2 minutes with sponsor XYZ paid for my travel, or sponsor X paid for my lodging, or I have a consulting relationship with sponsor whoever. I mean, it's
you don't hear so much about the travel and lodging ever since we've been in the virtual world for the past 4 years.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of
certainly
the,
when
the,
it was
yeah,
in person.
Days.
Yes, you would see a lot of patients who would disclose that their travel had been paid for, or that they sit on the patient advisory board of company X, or that they were, you know, in the clinical trial that the committee is debating.
Yeah, it's even the patient groups are really good about taking up, lots of public hearing speaker slots, especially if they're in favor of approval and so forth, too. So, again, it's not an uncommon thing. It's not just an oncology thing. But I guess I'm not sure you could really get rid of it. I mean, you could say no one who has any conflict can testify, but then it's not an open hearing. So, I don't know. I guess I'm not sure how you fix this problem other than just continue to complain about it. But I wonder if there's something that can be done maybe to encourage more diverse opinions, because I keep talking about the Teplerson Advisory Committee meeting because, it's becoming a more and more of kind of a seminal or landmark advisory committee meeting, even though it's been several years now since it occurred, because of the things that happened during it and then since. But that OPH went on for something like 2.5 hours, and it was almost all patients, which is fine. But there were a few who made statements that questioned Teplerson's efficacy and some of the data and raised some questions. And you heard, there were people in the crowd who did not appreciate that and made it known. That's probably a nice way of saying it. I heard lots of stories I didn't witness myself about some of the things that happened in those cases. So, you know, you wonder if that's happened in other advisory committees, especially some of the more, you know, the ones for, you know, more popular drugs or that are more closely followed and you know, kind of like these rare disease settings. And you wonder if opposition voices are, I mean, I don't know if scared's the right word, but do you want to put up with, you know, having a room full of a couple hundred people, you know, staring you down if you say something they don't want to hear? I don't know. Maybe submit something to the docket.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I remember, and this is going back a ways, but the 2011 public hearing on Avastin's accelerated approval withdrawal, that public hearing lasted, it was at least 2 hours, and the room was filled with patients and patient advocates. And there were some who did not support keeping the breast cancer indication on label, and they were treated not nicely by other members in the audience that day, to put it mildly.
And Sue, I remember from your story, there was an anecdote about how the advisory committee members themselves had to be sort of spirited away in some sort of kind of back exit to sort of kind of avoid the ire of the audience. If I'm remembering that correctly, so it's not just speakers that can sort of kind of get that kind of hostility, but it's advisory committee members themselves who sort of kind of who say things that the audience may not appreciate.
Absolutely. And I think that the other thing of concern, that I've noticed is the disclosure issues is, like, people who speak during the open public hearing are encouraged to disclose any interest they have in it. But if they do not disclose it, it will not preclude them from speaking. That is stated at the beginning of every single open public hearing. And Dr. Pastor has previously complained, and I'm not really sure if it's in the context of the open public hearing or the formal presentations, but when these academic or investigators come up and speak in favor of the companies, their disclosures are pretty sparse. And he has talked about how CME program, their disclosures are, or even journal articles, disclosures are much more comprehensive than they are at an advisory committee meeting for these outside investigators and academic experts who speak.
The other thing I've heard too, and again, this is just like kind of, you know, a compilation of, you know, comments I've heard at, you know, various, you know, conferences and public forums and conversations with people when they start talking about this, is that the FDA folks have said, and to an extent, I think the advisory committee members too have said that, like, you know, we know, like, when people get up there and say, so-and-so paid for my travel, or I was in the clinical trial or whatever, like, they understand that what that means, and to, you know, they kind of know how to take that comment, so to speak. It doesn't mean they disregard it completely, but they know, they understand the, you know, the reason you're disclosing that, you know. So, you know, maybe there's, you know, again, I don't know how you fix this. I don't think you can fix it, but at least, you know, you hope there's some understanding of how to take the comments from these people who had their, you know, whether it's you had your travel or you were in the trial or you're on the patient group that invested in the development or whatever, you know what, right. I mean?
Yeah, I feel like some of it can be on FDA to educate the advisory committee and even the public about, you know, some of the dynamics that affect who comes to speak at meetings and who doesn't. And, you know, first of all, I was pretty shocked, and I kind of feel like Pastor had to be exaggerating that he's never seen somebody speak against the product at a hearing, because, again, Sue just mentioned the Avastin one. It's less common, but it's not, it exists. But I mean, I think you can remind people, and particularly in something like cancer, if you're talking about late stage cancers, right, there's, you know, a survival bias, right? If somebody died in the trial, they are not there
to say it didn't work. Yeah.
That the drug didn't work for me. And, you know, the likelihood that their family or somebody related to them is necessarily going to do that is probably slim, unless they really felt like there was something particularly egregious, you know, about the product or something that's being covered up, right? You know, so, and I think that those things are, you just have to educate on, because I guess, and this is probably, I think, coming a bit from like my journalistic sort of bias to thinking about, you know, public engagement, and, you know, you don't want to, you could start to get into issues around, I think, like censorship or, you know, other things that you don't want to get into if you start trying to control who's speaking or can't speak in certain ways. So I think you do have to err on the side of, like, unfortunately, you can't totally stop this gaming, right, of the sponsors to some extent of who comes, because they are going to aggressively encourage their supporters to come, right? But you can be very clear and transparent with the committee members and everybody else about that dynamic. I do wonder a little bit with like the virtual meetings and people testifying virtually, which again has lots of positives because, right, a particularly sick person with travel limitations or just financial limitations is not necessarily going to be able to come to White Oak and, you know, to give a 30-second speech or however many minutes they're lucky to get. That also means that, right, the sponsor might have recruited people to speak that don't quite have financial ties or the types of ties people normally disclose, right? Because they don't need the sponsor to pay for their travel or a hotel room. So maybe the potential sort of conflicts or, you know, biases aren't as clear sometimes in maybe the virtual formats. But you have to do that education. And, you know, I've definitely felt like in a lot of the panels I've covered recently that the committee has been very, committees have, you know, really taken to heart some of the very passionate stories of patients. And I think it's important for them to kind of understand, you know, the context and the things that patients value or don't. But again, you also have to like imagine that the bulk of their work is to really look at kind of like, to take that, but then also think about what the data is showing. And again, to remember, like, you can't, you know, let sort of one antidote, you know, overcome the data if the data doesn't, you know, isn't backed up by what, you know, one group of people is pushing.
That's a great point, Sarah. I was thinking about, as you were talking about sort of kind of, you know, what the best way to sort of kind of bring a patient story forward is Ellen Siegel, obviously, you know, the, you know, her work with the founding Friends of Cancer Research, and obviously sort of kind of very involved in, you know, trying to sort of move more expeditiously on drug development. But, you know, she's also talked a lot about how her sister had terrible toxicity sort of at the end of her life. She was fighting cancer and sort of kind of that didn't really sort of kind of do much for her. And sort of kind of how do you balance that need for, you know, moving products forward if they have, you know, some chance of helping people, but sort of kind of not not harming them unnecessarily. And obviously, you know, there's only one Ellen Siegel, but sort of kind of that if there was a way to sort of kind of imbibe that spirit more in the comments and sort of kind of have that full context, it would be, I think, sort of better for all the decision makers and for the patients themselves as they went through these journeys.
I mean, to a certain extent, you even see, it seems like it's kind of a lot of familiar groups or faces that come to these, even to say to the open public hearings, even to say you need to look at the data closely. It's not as, you know, there are a lot of questions here. I mean, I think we've all seen, you know, there are some groups and they're really good about looking at clinical trial data and they raise these questions. So, you know, I wonder if too some of it just kind of you get so used to hearing it over and over again. And, you know, maybe that's just my, you know, our bias because we're going to these meetings all the time. But, you know, yeah, I'm still kind of, yeah, I'm not sure how you would necessarily bring more, you know, genuine comments and a kind of a more diverse opinion or voice to, you know, to the open public hearings.
And I mean, I guess, I mean, you know, the more I think about this, like, this is sort of a, I think, government-wide sort of problem, I think, with, like, feedback and things to, like, anything going on in the political sphere and sector that, you know, there are plenty of sort of, it's not like a pharma-specific thing, right, where issue groups that are passionate or have some kind of interest, you know, kind of work together, petitions or other things or get signers, right? Like, we're used to this even seeing in comments on rulemaking or things, you know, some of the patient groups and sometimes affiliate with industry, right, get their patients to sort of try and sign on to the same comments and letters. And, you know, you don't necessarily hear from people who may have different opinions because some of these people don't even realize this comment process is going on, right? Like, not everybody knows to follow the Federal Register and not every, you know, cancer patient, you know, has any sense of all these policies. So again, I think it's like thinking about like there is a value to all these public comment processes and they're important, but also again, just remembering what they not are. They're not a representative like sample, you know, or poll, yeah. You know, and the people at FDA and who are on advisory committees should at least, I think, be very well positioned to understand that, right? Those nuances, right? To appreciate that all that stuff around, again, those sort of biases or the limitations to the data that you get when you do these processes. Yeah, I don't know. I appreciate Pastor's concern, and I certainly think it does. I can understand why it can kind of cause some problems for FDA with public perception, and you know, if they get a big open public hearing that's pushing one way, and the data or you know whatnot is pushing them another way. But at the same time, I think they should have the capabilities to sort of balance this problem and to some degree.
Yeah, I don't know if it's there needs to be some sort of announcement from FDA at the beginning and end of public comment periods about the speakers may have been compensated and may not have disclosed that, and survival bias may dictate for kind of who's able to appear and anything like that. That's for kind of maybe sort of puts it in more of a context, even for kind of people listening to sort of that aren't on the panel to sort of kind of appreciate sort of what factors go into sort of kind of who's actually at the mic and who might not be.
Yeah, my new thing when I win the lottery, I'm going to hire a professional staff to write formal comments to federal rulemaking for me. That's like my new thing. So I'm constantly involved.
I think you need to get some better lottery winning goals, Derek.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think AI is going to put your lottery dreams out of a job, Derek. I think.
But before we go on, I'd also like to register my concerns. This is actually a timely subject because as we're recording now at 10:51 a.m., ODAC is meeting and in person for the first time in I don't know how long it's been at the White Oak at its FDA's White Oak headquarters. Unfortunately, while the whole committee, all the sponsor people and the FDA people are there, they did not allow the public or the press or the open public hearing speakers to be there in person. They're all participating virtually. Now, you know, this isn't just me because I'm a reporter and I don't like being excluded. This is like, if you can accommodate a lot of people, why can't you accommodate everybody? And I don't know the answer to that question. You know, there are all kinds of logistical issues that went into just getting meetings back into White Oak to begin with. Maybe this is a practice run for the return, the full return to normal operations that they're planning, you know, that, the Office of New Drugs and OCE and everybody has talked about is coming later this year. But I just want to go on the record saying I hope they can get everybody who wants to go into the room again soon.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Peter Stein, the director of the Office of New Drugs, he has talked about how when they do go back in person, the open public hearings, that will still... It sounds like that will still sort of have virtual elements if need be, because it does allow patients certainly to participate if they have travel limitations or just it's too difficult to get to White Oak in person. But in terms of allowing the general public and the press to come in, I would expect that the next ODAC meeting we'd all be able to go, but we will see. I guess the next ODAC meeting is actually the pediatric subcommittee in May. And if my memory is correct, the Federal Register notice said that was an entirely virtual meeting, so that there would be some, you know, going backwards in that regard.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But, you know, just, you know, want it out there. Just, you know, it's not, you know, if you can have some people in person, you could probably have everybody. So who wants to go anyway? With the virtual component if it's necessary. So just throwing it out there. Next up, we're going to go back to Sue. There were also discussions during the conference of problems with, I guess, clinical trial diversity plans.
Yes. Yeah, so there was some interesting regulatory news that came out of the AACR annual meeting this year. So one of the sessions was on clinical trial diversity plans, and there were a couple of folks from the FDA's oncology division who talked about how they're concerned that sponsors are not reaching diverse enough, doing outreach to diverse enough groups for help in terms of coming up and with and implementing these diversity plans. So an April 2022 guidance had recommended that sponsors submit diversity plans to ensure that traditionally underrepresented ethnic and racial groups are in fact enrolled in clinical trials. And under the FDORA legislation, which was enacted in December 2022, these what they're calling diversity action plans will eventually be required of sponsors. And those relate not just to ethnicity and race, but also age and sex and some other key demographics. So FDA has been looking through these diversity plans that were submitted under the April 2022 guidance. So it's gotten a good sense of sort of what how sponsors are putting these together. And definitely a couple of people from the oncology division said, we want to see more diversity in the groups that you're working with. I think there's concern that they keep going back to the same patient groups and they don't see these, FDA is concerned these same patient groups are not really representing everybody in the patient community, such as those who do live in the community or live in under, you know, are represent underserved areas.
Yeah, I tweeted this headline when it came out the other day, and my first thought was just kind of connecting this to a lot of things FDA has said about supply chain issues, which is, right, you know, you have to know your supply chain, you have to do your due diligence. So apparently you got to do your due diligence on clinical, on the, you know, the patient groups you're dealing with. But by the way, can I say it's ironic that we've already discovered diversity problems in clinical trial diversity plans? I don't know.
It
know,
makes for a tricky headline.
Yes. But I mean, the other question about this is what FDA is asking, is it feasible, whether it's practically feasible, I mean, or financially feasible? I know they've, you know, everybody has said, we want to get out into the community. We want to engage some of these areas. We want to do research in areas that aren't necessarily right next to academic medical centers and, you know, go to community facilities and all this kind of stuff. But it's, you know, it's a lot more difficult to kind of put that into practice and put money behind that. So, you know, I don't know if it's practical or financially feasible.
Well, that was sort of the focus of this whole panel, was what is actually happening. And we have the diversity plans, but what is actually happening in practice? And there was definitely a sense on the panel, which included patient representatives and people from industry, as well as somebody from a company who sort of works, straddles the two, right, in terms of getting people into the community, that you can find these people, but you just need to dig deeper, right? You need to work harder at it instead of just going back to the same resource that you've used over and over again.
I mean, I think COVID and the vaccine trials there have been seen as a success for really saying we need to prioritize and make sure we have diversity in trials and really commit to doing it, even if it wasn't always quite. I think that I don't think that just saying this is hard or this is more expensive is going to get the industry out of this. Particularly, I mean, this is a evergreen issue. It strikes me as one of those issues that we've, you know, covered and thought about for so long. You're sort of like, wait, this hasn't been solved yet. You know, it's one of those things where to me, it's sort of like, wait, we're still working on this to some extent. Because it doesn't seem like, you know, figuring out, you know, what really is the, you know, cause of Alzheimer's or the druggable target for Alzheimer's, you know, it just seems a lot simpler. And I think, like, thinking about everything with, like, the cost of medicines and all this other stuff in this country that people are just not going to let companies or the agencies in some ways off the hook for just saying, like, this is hard and throwing up their hands. Because I know, like I covered, I had a story that ran this week, you know, where I saw the head of the ACIP for CDC speaking on a panel, and, you know, she brought up that, you know, companies want easier to implement recommendations from ACIP for their vaccines. But then they don't, you know, if you don't have the populations in the trial that you want covered, you know, is it on the CDC for making the recommendation complicated, or is it on the company? And is it on the CDC if the cost effectiveness balance isn't there, or is it on the company? So I think, you know, I'm not saying this stuff is easy, but, you know, and I get that the costs of conducting clinical trials seem like everybody says they're always going up, But at the same time, this is in general also not a resource poor industry. And it is an industry that is, you know, saying they're committed to health and, you know, helping people. And they need to, I think, be able to put their money and their, you know, commitment where their mouth is and really be helping everybody, you know. And, you know, I mean, now, again, like, is there some, you know, sort of, you do have to reconsider, you know, like, to get what you need in a clinical trial and to address the real world, right? The populations are never going to be able to be perfectly the same as, you know, real world populations, because otherwise you never kind of be able to have the control in a trial you want. But, you know, I just think, we're definitely too far down the diversity needs to happen role to just throw up our hands and say, we can't do this.
I mean, there's also there's the law now.
Right.
The law is going to require, not yet, but the law is going to require that sponsors submit these diversity action plans to FDA. And it's going to be real interesting when this finally takes effect, which is going to be a while yet. What happens when FDA gets these plans, if it doesn't like these plans, or if when the trials are being done, they really don't follow these plans? You know, what is FDA going to do in terms of redress? We've seen the agency now starting to issue complete response letters because it does not believe the confirmatory trials are sufficiently advanced at the time of accelerated approval. So what's it going to do when it gets to the point where somebody's done a big phase 3 trial, didn't really follow the diversity plan, it's not very diverse, what's FDA going to do with that data?
Well, I think, you know, if the oncology president is any example, they may issue a complete response letter at that point. That would be sort of a real major blow for the companies. You know, I think we've seen this in you know, clinical trials, just not just in the diversity issue, but in terms of sort of kind of, you know, FDA encouraging sort of kind of, you know, new models of trials and, you know, companies in some ways for kind of wanting to stick with what they've always done because, you know, they know it and don't want to sort of kind of be the folks who are kind of trying something new and then it doesn't work out. And you can kind of see that in the same question with, you know, well, we know we've used these groups, these, you know, vendors before to sort would help us with diversity recruitment, and why don't we stick with them as opposed to trying someone without the same track record? So that could be a reason that they're sort of holding back. And I think there's a whole host of reasons aside from just kind of throwing up your hands and saying it's hard. Is you don't want to be the person to try something new and then have it sort of kind of be a failure. So just sort of kind of think there's some sort of caution in general about that as well. And it's an important conversation. Sightline, our parent company, is having a webinar on April 23rd about what they're calling navigating the maze of diversity in the clinical trials. And there's a great panel, folks from GSK, Pfizer, AbbVie, BMS are going to speak on it, and hopefully have a lot of interesting and useful things to say. We'll include the registration link in the show notes for this podcast. And, I think there's going to be a lot of worthwhile things shared at that webinar.
Yeah, Matt, I was thinking the same thing as you were. You hear these stories all the time too, that companies kind of fall in love with certain investigators because they're so good at enrolling and getting the number of patients they need at their site, so they keep going back to them over and over again because of the track record. How do you train new investigators when you keep using the same ones over and over again? So, yeah, I think it's going to use. I think it's going to take a kind of one big successful use case to kind of push everyone along. Like if someone's able to show, COVID was kind of a big use case for a lot of these decentralized trial ideas and so forth. If somebody shows that it's possible, you can get a highly diverse trial and work at the community level, and here's what we did and here's how we did it and here's how we got into these local centers and we trained the investigators and we did all this stuff and the data was still good and it came in and we got approved and it wasn't an outrageous cost or anything like that, then I think people are willing to try it. But we'll be willing to try it, but like Matt said, I think there's this, kind of fear of being the first one through the door because you don't know how, things are going to go and you can't really control the outcome. Finally, we're going to discuss Stealth Biotherapeutics' elamipretide, which is a candidate for the treatment of Barth syndrome, a rare disease. The FDA refused to file the NDA in 2021, but Stealth refiled it earlier this year, and the FDA now has decided to review it. That's itself is not unusual, but the CEO of Stealth, Renee McCarthy, told us that the company still does not have clear guidance on whether it should get more clinical data, which is a potentially big question. She also said the company likely has its work cut out for them to convince the FDA to approve the product. One red flag that already has emerged is the FDA's decision to grant a standard review rather than a priority review. Elamipretide already has fast track, orphan drug, and rare pediatric disease designations, which one would think it gets a faster review. McCarthy continues to worry that the FDA on cardiology division's inexperience with rare diseases may be impacting things. And continuing on our advisory committee theme today, an advisory committee meeting for this product is expected, but there isn't any indication yet which committee will be called. The cardiorenal drugs ADCOM makes sense, but McCarthy also wondered if the genetic metabolic diseases committee, which specializes in rare diseases, could also be used, assuming it's ready. That committee's members haven't been announced yet. So for all of you, I'm curious what you all think of this, the standard instead of priority review. What does that say to you about the application? Do you all agree that Stealth has maybe some concerns here as the review kind of ramps up?
I think they FDA filed it to just sort of air it, get it out in the open. Let's get all the issues on the table there, and the fact that they're not giving it a priority review. They're just sort of taking their time with this, I think. It reminds me of an application that they took a number of years ago. It was a DMD application, Translarna, I think. And they did the same sort of thing. They had, either told the sponsor not to file, or they issued or refused to file, and then the sponsor filed again, and they ended up going to an advisory committee meeting on this. And, it didn't turn out well for the sponsor. But I think this is a way of FDA to get it out there and on the table. And for the patient community, an advisory committee is going to be a bonanza of open public hearing testimony in favor of approval.
Yeah, we'll have to have Bridget on here to sort of give us the exact breakdown of the percentage of applications that received those various designations of significance, but did not get a priority review. There are a few. It's not a common occurrence, and some of them even do get approved on the first cycle, even without the priority review. But as Sue was saying, it's probably going to be the advisory committee that's for kind of sponsors were kind of hear what they need to do, and then the FDA is going to hear it from the patient community, assuming stealth and the advocates are going to have the wherewithal, we're going to put all the folks in front of the committee as usually happens. So interesting to see how it all plays out. I would say if I were a sponsor and I were sort of uncertain as to sort of kind of what FDA wanted, I think filing an application is kind of an expensive step, but they've got it in front of the agency now, and they'll have a public discussion, and that's probably sort of kind of what they wanted perhaps more than absolute clarity on next steps, and they'll get it one way or another, maybe sort of an expensive and extended process for them. But the complete response letter, if that's what comes, we'll sort of kind of have some specifics, and then those were going to be entitled to more meetings after that. So it's a unfortunate that it's sort of had to sort of kind of work out this way, but this is a at least sort of a formal path forward for them if they're feel stymied otherwise.
Yeah, I think I wonder too if maybe they think they can get a lot of the questions answered with a post-marketing, with post-marketing requirements and so forth, not necessarily an accelerated approval, but because that one, the FDA has already said they aren't sure about yet. But, that was another option that's been thrown out there is, we've committed to a registry, we're willing to do post-marketing trials and, all kinds of, those sorts of things. So yeah, I don't know if it awkward is the right situation. I wonder, I think what Sue said is that probably they're trying to get everything out there on the table. They want to have a public discussion of this. They want to be able to talk publicly about it, as opposed to now where they're barred by law from saying anything. So, they can say, these are the questions we have. These are the problems we have. This is why you need to do whatever we feel like you need to do. If they decide that they, they need to do something else, and then maybe they can, add some clarity. Well, that's all for today. For more, check out our website at www.thepinksheet.com. You can also find this and other podcasts on the Sightline channel in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Spotify Podcasts, as well as smart speakers if they are your default podcast provider. Thanks again for listening to Drug Fix. I'm Derek Ingery with Sarah Carlin-Smith, Sue Sutter, and Nielsen Hobbs. Take care, and we'll see you next time.